Football Weekly is on the air.
Hi, I'm Hub Arkish, along with senior editor Eric Edholm and the entire Pro Football Weekly editorial staff, as we bring you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, where every week we bring you all the news, scoops, and rumors before they happen from around the NFL.
We'll talk about the effect the lockout is having on the teams and what big-name quarterback might be on the market when they come back.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Hello all, and welcome into this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. I am Hub Arkish, the publisher and editor at PFW, along with our senior editor, Eric Edholm. The entire Pro Football Weekly editorial staff will be joining us in just a few moments, but first we wanted to get you up to date on the latest from the NFL owners' meetings in New Orleans this past week, the NFL players' meetings in Marco Island, Florida this past week. Of course, not a lot happened on the labor impasse, but some significant rules changes. And, Eric, the one that I think has most folks talking is the decision allegedly to make the game safer in changing kickoff plays, moving the ball up to the 35 from the 30-yard line. There was talk about making a touchback come out to the 25. That was tabled. Touchbacks will still come to the 20. There was also talk about doing away with the two-man wedge, no wedges on kickoffs. That was tabled as well. Apparently what happened is the competition committee presented their initial rule with the moving the ball up, with extending the touchback, with taking the wedges out, and the coaches reacted badly. They went back home Monday night and talked about it, came back Tuesday, and got passed by a vote of 26-6, this limited change on kickoffs.
Yeah, I think people thought it was too confusing. They thought there were too many moving parts. You know, I mean, coaches were talking about, hey, I'm still learning last year's rules, and I'm still trying to figure out what the impact of those would be. So, you know, I think this is a lot cleaner, a lot simpler. Bill Belichick, one of the more outspoken coaches on it, he said he likes the new system better than the initial proposal. So, you know, the only people who seem to be unhappy right now are the Devin Hesters, the Joshua Cribbs, the Leon Washingtons of the world, the great returners in this game.
Well, one other change to the rule that some took as nuance, but it is more than that, is also on the kickoff from the kicking team, only the kicker will be allowed to line up more than 5 yards behind the football. Now, you had teams with their coverage guys getting 10, 12-yard head starts, building up ahead of steam. Allegedly, this change is to make the game safer. Now, apparently, there was evidence presented to the coaches that there are more significant injuries on kick coverage plays. I haven't seen that evidence. I know Joe Cribbs is one who's been very outspoken, very upset about this, said he certainly hasn't seen it. The players haven't seen it. But really, I think the reaction to this rule more than anything is owners, you're telling us that you want to make the game safer. This may eliminate 10 or 15% of the kick returns, but you want us to play two more games. Those things just don't go together.
Yeah. How many plays does that equate to over the course of a season? I think everybody can still remember Kevin Everett, obviously the real serious neck injury with the Bills player, the tight end. You know, and that was a kickoff play, and I think that's one that you can point to and say absolutely. You know, and in theory, these are players who are running straight at each other, head of steam. You know, that's where the 40-yard dash comes into play in football, and these guys theoretically could get some really serious crashes here, but we're eliminating a handful of plays and some of the most exciting plays in football. I think that's where fans and the kick returners are scratching their heads and say, how much more safer is the game really, and are you taking away from the excitement of it?
Well, and I would also argue, and again, if the competition committee has the evidence, we'd love to see it, that in fact these plays are more dangerous.
Yep.
But this is the one play where all 22 guys should be running with their heads up. They should be able to see where they're going. There really shouldn't be any helmet-to-helmet collisions on these plays. Now, I know they happen on occasion. You just mentioned Everett. But the bottom line is that it really does strike at the fabric of the game. One of the most exciting plays in football. There will still be kick returns. There will still be kick returns for touchdowns, but probably a few less of them. The other big rule change, and there was actually four in total, but the second one that probably generated the most conversation, is all scoring plays will now be subject to booth review, and the review will be called for, decided upon by the official upstairs. That is a significant change as to making the coaches use their challenges on those plays.
Yeah, and this passed by a 30-2 vote. Clearly a lot of support for it. My question is, when do coaches start using them? We always criticize coaches. Don't use your challenges in the first half. Save them for huge momentum-changing plays. Save them for potential touchdowns, fourth down plays like that. So now, will coaches start to use them in the first half? Will they use them, you know, a little bit more liberally? Use the same rules apply as far as if you hit on your first two, you still get a third challenge back, kind of the bonus there. So I'll be curious to see how coaches use this. This may actually have more of a strategic impact than the kickoff will.
Well, and it makes the game easier for the coaches on the field. I mean, yeah. Basically it gives them more challenges because they don't have to waste them on these. Now, what I'm not clear on is if you can use one of your challenges to ask the official upstairs to review the play if he doesn't call for it himself. That's something we really need to check on, because the bottom line is if that's not the case, this will lengthen games because now both coaches will still have their two replays, plus they'll be calling for replays upstairs, and that's something that the league has been trying to avoid. That said, it also takes some of the strategy out from some of these coaches. But I think it was John Harbaugh, the Ravens coach, was one of the real outspoken guys who said, hey, we need to do this because the road team is at a disadvantage. When the play favors, or there's a perception that the play favors the home team, you don't see it on the video screen. And so that certainly, you know, is a good reason. It would be understandable. A less significant rule, some think, is that now penalties on dead ball plays at the end of the half will not be enforced regardless of which team they were on. In the past, some were enforced, some weren't. This just eliminates, I think, some confusion, really.
Yeah, that's one, I think, again, an effort to clean up the game. But, you mentioned the length in the game part. You know, a couple of years ago, that was all the talk, was getting these games under 3.5 hours. And they've done a pretty good job away from that. But they've also taken plays out of the game. The kickoff is among them, and yet these replays are going to keep extending things. So from that standpoint, we keep getting in a circle.
Well, and the biggest surprise of the meetings was the rule that didn't get changed. The competition committee came to the meetings with 8 plays that they wanted defined to take the excessive violence out of the game. They were going to define them in such a way that too many coaches and owners thought they just confused the issue more, and so they were tabled. Now, there will be another round of meetings in May. This may still happen, but the big move that was supposed to be made to make the game safer and to take away the confusion that was created when the league office decided in mid-season last year to let Ray Anderson be the ultimate arbiter of all this, nothing was done there because they just still don't feel they have the language to figure out what's unsafe and what isn't.
Yeah, I'm also going to be curious to see, you know, when it comes out in the new CBA, when appeals on these kinds of things, you know, who hears them? You know, is it going to be Goodell? Is it going to be Anderson? Is it a league officer? Is it going to be an interesting third party that could be involved here? So, yeah, a few things that we still need to sort out.
Well, and I promised an update on the labor impasse, but quite frankly, both sides met and nothing happened, but they called each other a lot of names. And I think they both made false accusations against the other. We have no real new information. We know what we knew going in. Judge Susan Nelson in the 8th Circuit in Minneapolis is going to hear the player's request for an injunction against the owners to enjoin them from locking them out. Both sides have now filed their briefs. We expect that she will rule sometime shortly after the 6th, certainly not that day, hopefully within a week or so. And depending on where that ruling goes, that probably is the next time we're going to hear anything substantial from either side.
Yeah, I mean, we could end up in appellate court. You know, obviously one side or the other may just decide, hey, we're going to appeal this thing. And who knows? We probably will not have a large free agency period before the draft.
Well, and the side that doesn't get ruled in favor of will appeal.
Yes.
We know that. But if it's the owners, even if they appeal, they're going to have to unlock the players, I guess is the way to say it. And so free agency will almost certainly start quickly while they're going about their appeal. That way, I guess the best way for us to have news soon is for the players to get their injunction. That's not to say it's the right thing or that's the way that she'll rule, but that will get football going again the quickest. We take a quick commercial break here. We're going again with The Way We Hear It right after this. You're listening to Pro Football Weekly. I'm Hub Arkish, along with Eric Edholm, and we are now joined by Executive Editor Dan Arkish. And Dan covers, amongst other teams, the NFC West and the St. Louis Rams. And, Dan, one of the kids that I was really excited about coming out of school last year was Marty Gilliard from the University of Cincinnati. As a matter of fact, after watching him in college, really couldn't understand how he lasted to the 4th round. Rare combination of size and speed, although I think the speed was part of the problem. And yet, as a rookie with the Rams, really didn't make much of an impact. But you're hearing that they're not ready to write him off by any means?
No, I don't think so. He's got way too much natural talent for them to give up on him. He just had one of those rookie seasons where everything that could go wrong did go wrong. He graduated late, and that caused a late start in terms of learning the playbook, and then he hurt his wrist. It was just one thing after another, and they had hoped to really get a lot more out of him. But they think that this year he's going to make a big jump, not necessarily as a number one receiver by any means, but a very productive guy that can be used in a lot of ways.
Interesting thought just occurred to me. I just cut off Eric. I apologize for that. But we keep looking for examples of how this unusual NFL offseason can hurt or help people, more hurt than help. Well, here's a kid, graduated late, didn't learn quickly enough. Now he's not working with coaches. So in spite of their optimism, I would imagine this is a kid they're really disappointed that they're not able to work with right now.
Oh, it's a terrible situation for the Rams on all levels. I mean, they have a new coordinator, Josh McDaniels, and you know that he's going to want to open things up. It was an extremely conservative situation under his predecessor, and they can't do anything. It's got to be hurting the Rams.
And yet when you see him in camp, obviously, Dan, he looks a lot like some of those former Patriots receivers, and now Josh McDaniels running that offense. I think he fits that well because he's got that yards after the catch kind of ability, and I think he might do pretty well in a McDaniels system.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, it's going to be really interesting to see just how closely Josh McDaniels can, you know, make that Ram offense to the type of attack that he, you know, so masterfully put together back in 2007.
Dan, the Seattle Seahawks, another one of your ball clubs, and head coach Pete Carroll have done their best to convince us that they really want Matt Hasselbeck back, and I don't doubt that they do, at least the Hasselbeck that played in that first playoff game for him in upsetting the New Orleans Saints. But now we're hearing a rumor that they could be the team that offered that number one draft choice to the Eagles for Kevin Kolb, or short of that, that they at least have inquired with the Philadelphia Eagles about the availability of Kolb?
You know, I think the rumors that they're interested in Kolb just continue to, you know, linger. And, I mean, as far as Hasselbeck goes, he is at best a short-term solution. He did earn himself a serious reprieve with the way he played in the playoffs. But if they think that Kolb could be the long-term guy, he's a good fit for the offense that Daryl Bevel wants to put together there. They might really make a push for him, but boy, the price is really high, guys, and that's what people have to wonder about with that.
The price is also high considering they gave up multiple draft picks for Charlie Whitehurst last year. I mean, where does he stand, Dan? We know he performed, you know, fairly admirably in the game to get into the playoffs against the Rams, put them in a good position to win that game over the Saints as far as winning the game to get into the postseason. But boy, I mean, they gave up a lot to get this guy, and now it really doesn't appear that with these rumors that he has a place in this team. Where do you see him fitting in?
Yeah, that's really a good question. It's hard to see where he really does fit in, you know, because his strength is the deep ball, and that's really not going to be nearly as much of a part of the offense under Bevel. So he remains this very curious work in progress that they paid a very high price for, and you really, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but they really apparently do like Kolb.
Dan, there have been various reports that new 49er head coach Jim Harbaugh and new general manager Trent Baalke may not be on quite the same page when it comes to quarterback. Harbaugh talking up Alex Smith, Baalke not necessarily a big fan. Now come rumors, although Trent Baalke, by the way, did go out of his way to report that they're absolutely on the same page at the owners' meetings this past week. But now come rumors that Jim Harbaugh may have his eyes on a backup quarterback in Tampa Bay.
Well, you know, he has a good familiarity with Josh Johnson, having coached him at the University of San Diego. And so, you know, it's a guy that he probably is looking at. The way we hear it, the Niners are exploring, you know, all avenues because they have to, you know, rectify that quarterback situation. And, you know, Alex Smith suddenly looks like he might, in great part just because of just the way the league is right now with all the uncertainty. Maybe he gets a second chance after all. But the whole thing there is, does he want to go back there? I keep hearing that he's really had his fill and wants to move on.
All right, Dan, thank you very much for your work on those stories. We'll check with you again next week. Right now, we're going to take a very short break, and then we've got more Way We Hear It with Eric Edholm. All right, guys, if you're a serious fan of the NFL, you know the story that's coming next, and you know why you read Pro Football Weekly. I know, a cheap shot, but I just couldn't resist it. Eric, one of the strangest stories I have ever heard, Dallas Cowboy wide receiver Dez Bryant, who keeps managing to find trouble but doesn't do anything horrible. He's just kind of out there in a gray area, was asked to leave the North Park Center, an upscale mall in the Dallas area, because he and three of his friends had their pants too low, their underwear was showing. Now, Bryant insists that it wasn't him, that it was his buddies, and that it was all a big misunderstanding. A, I didn't know that you could be kicked out of a mall for having your underwear shy.
You didn't know that?
Yeah. I mean, the whole story is a little strange, but it is worth noting that Bryant keeps running into these kind of things.
I think, you know, the question is, would this have happened to Miles Austin or any other Cowboys wide receiver? When he came out of Oklahoma State, the knock on Bryant was that he just seemed to sort of find trouble. He was a kid whose head wasn't quite screwed on straight, and then he needed hard coaching, tough love, whatever you want to call it. And that's why he slipped to the 24th pick. I think talent-wise, he's right up there with, you know, guys that we're talking about as top 10 picks this year, A.J. Green, Julio Jones, whoever. But, I mean, the reason why he slid is that there were some teams that didn't want to deal with him. And some of the stuff you get is this. Now, granted, is this the worst defense in the world? No, I don't think so. But there are some concerns that, you know, maybe he's going to continue to have these kinds of things happen, hang out with the wrong people, whatever you want to say. And so we'll see. It's a maturity thing with him, and maybe eventually he'll grow up.
Well, and I think the real concern here, I have no reason to doubt Bryant. He said his pants were up. It was his friends. But off-duty police were concerned enough about Bryant's reaction to escort him and his group from the mall and issue a criminal trespass warning. His reaction is what we're talking about here. And that's really the focus of all this. You know, and I got a quote here from Bryant. I told the guy, I'm not trying to get in trouble. I'm not trying to destroy my image, close quote. Maybe he wasn't. Maybe his pants were up, but you've got to be able to rep. And this, by the way, is not the first time he's had a misunderstanding at this mall.
Yeah, exactly. That's the other thing is that, you know, I mean, the fact that they wanted to, you know, exit him from the premises tells you that, look, I don't care how brutal this rent-a-cop was. He obviously had some grounds for doing this. And I think that's just the way that Bryant maybe challenges authority. And so does, you know, the obvious transition question is he going to do that with Jason Garrett? Is he going to be a problem for this team on and off the field? The talent is there. I mean, he was exceptional in 12 games before getting hurt. So, I mean, they just got to find a way to get this guy sort of focused on the team program.
And let's be clear, folks, we're not picking on the kid. No. I'm not suggesting his version of the story isn't true, but you can't forget that 3 or 4 weeks ago there was a rumor out there that the Cowboys had inquired about the possibility of trading him for a high draft choice. Now, Stephen Jones, Jerry's son, immediately said, that's nuts, we would never do it. But you hear rumors like that, then stuff like this happens, and that's why you've got to at least stay on top of these stories. One other note on the Dallas Cowboys, as well as the Miami Dolphins, multiple sources are reporting that of the 5 teams fined by the NFL for, I don't want to say illegal, but a violation of the rules and having contact between their coaches and their players during this dead period where the last league year has expired and no new league year has begun. Allegedly, the Cowboys and the Dolphins are 2 of those 5 teams that were fined. Supposedly, Rob Ryan spent some time with some of the Cowboys' defensive players.
Yeah, and I mean, we reported it as a whisper last week, and then the more we kind of dug into this thing, we realized that this was a dead period. The coaches weren't allowed to talk to the players. So this is one of those examples of, you know, a team trying to get a leg up in this time where coaches and players are not allowed to talk. You've got a new defensive coordinator with I wouldn't say a vastly different system, but, you know, some different terminology and a lot of different things that Wade Phillips and the previous defensive coaches didn't employ in Dallas. And so, you know, the players, they're trying to catch up, but it's just not allowed under the league rules right now.
Well, and again, I think the thing that is troubling to a lot of people is that Jerry Jones has a bullseye on his back right now. He is considered, if not the leader, one of the leaders of the owner's position in this whole thing, and therefore responsible for this whole mess. And now it's his team that is allegedly breaking the rules. Again, you can't ignore this stuff. You know, how serious the violation was, we really don't know. Finally, we talked to Dan Arkish in the last segment about the possibility that Seattle is interested in Kevin Call. We don't know that to be the fact or not, but we're pretty sure that the Eagles at this point are at least fielding offers and finding out if they can get that first round pick or what they can get for Kevin Call.
And there's no question, Hub. I talked to some Eagles sources just 24 hours after the playoff loss to the Green Bay Packers and had to end each conversation with the same way. You know, is Kevin on the trading block? And both said no, but they also said, look, we've got to look around. We've got to see what his value is. So there was no question in my mind that they would kick those tires. And look, they're following last year's playbook with Donovan McNabb. Right at this time last year, Andy Reid said, yeah, we love Donovan, but we'd be willing to listen to offers. So the same thing. He's been praising Cobb up and down. You have to think they're going to go out there and let all these teams bid up against each other and see what they'll offer.
All right, Eric, we take another quick break here. Next up, Michael Blunda tells us what's going on with the Chiefs offense, and Dan Parr with some notes on the Saints and the Bears. It's right around the corner.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
We are on the air, and we are talking NFL football. They may be locked out around the NFL, but there are still plenty of stories to report the way we hear it. And we check in now with Associate Editor Michael Blunda. Michael is not only the fantasy doctor at Pro Football Weekly, one of the leading fantasy football experts in the country, but he covers the Kansas City Chiefs and San Diego Chargers for us. The Chargers, one of those teams happy about the new kickoff rule, but Michael, they're too easy a target. I'm not going to pick on them. Not only does Nate Kading not have much of a leg, but they can't cover kickoffs to save their lives. So maybe they got a break there. The Kansas City Chiefs, though, are the team I want to talk about because they are not getting a break at all. Matt Cassel had arguably a better year last year than he did that first year in New England where he earned that $63 million contract. But now a new quarterback coach in Jim Zorn, a new offensive coordinator in Bill Muir, and no chance to even talk to these guys and find out what the playbook looks like or what the terminology is going to be until after this labor mess gets cleared up.
Yeah, he's definitely in a tough spot. I mean, a lot of teams are going to be hurt by this lockout, especially ones that have younger players. But Matt Cassel in particular, you know, he broke out last season. Now this is going to be his fourth different offensive coordinator in as many years, and he won't even be able to talk to him, you know, until closer to the season. So it's going to be a tough spot for him. And the offense, which has a lot of young players on it, including quite a few second-year guys, they're not going to be able to practice. And you've got to wonder how much improvement they're really going to make coming into the 2011 season.
And Cassel, of course, is trying to challenge the record of Jason Campbell for most offensive coordinators in a career, which I think is something like 8. But let's face it, this is still Todd Haley's offense. It's still his team. I'm curious how closely these two guys are tied together, because obviously, you know, people, the expectations have been raised. You know, the bar has been set a lot higher after last season winning the West 10-6 record. Is there an expectation that because Castle's had so little football that he might take an even bigger jump next year?
Yeah, it's always possible. I mean, he's excelled in this new offense this past season, at least. You know, the first year in Kansas City wasn't great, but it was used it as a stepping stone for the 2010 year, which he really took a big step. So, you know, the two of these guys are definitely tied together, but I think you got to expect Matt Cassel to continue playing well. I wouldn't expect him to take a big step back, even though it is a new offensive coordinator. It's still Todd Haley's offense, like you said.
All right, Michael, thank you very much. And, of course, the most remarkable thing about Cassel last year, that touchdown-to-interception ratio, manage the game, make the occasional big play. We want to talk to Dan Parr, Associate Editor Dan Parr, about a guy who makes nothing but big plays. Marcus Colston is going into his contract year. He is under contract with the New Orleans Saints. He'll be a free agent at the end of the year. The New Orleans Saints have made him an absolute priority. But, Dan, they've got 26 players who are free agents. Are they going to try and get Colston done before they even worry about the rest? Or what do they do? The one thing we know is that when free agency does happen, it's going to happen fast, and teams are going to have to move quick.
That's right, Hub. And this is another situation where negotiations on a long-term deal for a key player like Colston could be a casualty of the lockout and some CBA uncertainty. I think that there's going to be a rush to kind of figure out what to do with those 26 players. They would like many of them back. They don't want to be turning over their roster completely. This is a team that had a very good year last year, although the playoff exit was a little bit of a surprise for them. They expected to beat the Seahawks in round one, but they like this group. They feel like the window isn't shut, and Colston is a guy who is going to be looking to test the market for the first time in his career. He would be an unrestricted free agent for the first time ever after next season. They did sign him to a three-year extension a few years ago, and at that time, general manager Mickey Loomis said that, you know, it was a nice bridge deal for him, and eventually he'd get to take another bite out of the apple. Well, I think he'd really like to take a huge bite, and it's not going to be cheap for the Saints to bring this guy back. He is the closest thing they have to a number one wide receiver.
Dan, another one of your teams, the Chicago Bears, and I'm trying to shy away from discussing who likes the kickoff change, who doesn't, that type of thing. But one team you knew had to be upset, and one team we know was one of the six clubs who voted against it was the Chicago Bears. Not only because Devin Hester may be the best kick returner ever, but the Chicago Bears have some of the best kick coverage teams in the league. They're just fantastic on special teams, and I guess Lovie Smith was very outspoken about his displeasure with the rule.
Yeah, not surprising, like you say, Hub. You would expect this kind of response from the Bears. After voting against it, this kind of came out of nowhere for a lot of people. Didn't see this one coming, and I think the Bears know that their offense, which was really horrific at times last year, really benefits from getting the opportunity to return kicks with Devin Hester back there. They returned 16 kickoffs in 2010 for 30 yards or more and 10 for 40 yards or more. So they're one of the league leaders at this, and this is going to take a big bite out of that offense.
Yeah, Dan, I'm looking at my calendar right now, and the NFC Championship game was about 2 months ago, so of course it's time for some Jay Cutler talk. There hasn't been much of it the last month or so. You know, Lovie Smith, when he was at the coach's breakfast, you know, meeting with the media, really the first time that he's spoken in a while, people, of course, asked him about Cutler. Did his message change at all? I mean, what did he have to say? What did you take away from that?
Well, he did say that he talked to Jay, which we, you know, haven't heard much of either secondhand reports of, you know, what Jay is saying these days. Lovey did say that it wasn't a lengthy conversation, so we don't know exactly what the nature of the talk was, but it's the same thing we've heard from Lovey since the NFC Championship game, which there's no reason to question Jay Cutler's toughness. He came out and the full team kind of wrapped its arms around Jay as soon as former players and current players started sounding off about whether he was tough or not in that loss to Green Bay. Be interesting to see what Cutler says once he finally does come out and talk to the media. Maybe we won't see it until training camp, if there is training camp. He certainly is in no rush to get to the microphone, and right now all we can go off of is Lovie Smith saying that he's going to be ready and that he's healing well from that injury.
Also curious whether they spoke before March 11th or after March 11th. Yeah, maybe they're another
right.
one of those five teams. Hey, Dan, thank you very much. We've got to take one more quick break, and then we've got more Way We Hear It coming up next. We are back with more of the latest in pro football here from Pro Football Weekly. I'm Hub Arkish, along with Eric Edholm. We now welcome in a couple more of our buddies on the editorial staff. Senior editor Mike Wilkening, who covers the AFC North and the Cincinnati Bengals. And Mike, it is not insignificant that both wide receiver coach James Urban and new offensive coordinator Jay Gruden, yeah, that's right, John's little brother, were attendees at Georgia's Pro Day, which featured, amongst others, A.J. Green, who should be a top five pick at wide receiver. Bengals at number four. Did they tip their hand there?
Hard to say. I think the Bengals can go any number of ways with this pick. And obviously, the thing about the Georgia Pro Day being there, scouts and coaches, NFL personnel were not allowed to watch because of an issue with the quarterback Justin Roper of Montana in terms of being able to throw at the workout. Long story short, wasn't eligible to throw per NFL rules, so scouts couldn't watch and coaches couldn't watch on the field as is. But it's clear, regardless of how Green participated as pro day or not, he's a guy that's going to merit interest at the top of the draft. He would make sense for Cincinnati and any number of teams. But the big question for them, obviously, is what do you do at that pick if Carson Palmer's situation is not cleared up by that time as well?
Well, that's what I was going to get into, Mike. And I mean, the bizarre hate triangle between President Mike Brown, who makes the personnel decision for the team, you know, and head coach Marvin Lewis, who's remained steadfast that he wants Palmer around, and Palmer, who said he's not playing for this team anymore. I mean, how does this get resolved?
Well, guys, it's going to be Mike Brown's decision. And Mike Brown has been pretty adamant that he doesn't see the sense at this point of really discussing trade with Carson Palmer, that he wants Carson Palmer back. But, you know, obviously, something may have to give here, because if Carson Palmer is not back, if he is steadfast and is not going to come back for this team, their starting quarterback is very likely not on the roster. So they're certainly a team to watch here in the weeks to come as the draft approaches.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're a little short on time. I'd ask about Ocho Cinco's soccer career, but it's not a three-hour show. So we'll talk about Ocho Cinco next week when we find out more. Now we welcome in Associate Editor Eli Cabaron, and Eli covers a lot of the AFC East for us and the New York Jets. And you know, Eli, a lot of people were surprised that the Jets were one of the teams that willingly voted for the new kickoff rule, in spite of the fact that they're one of only a handful of teams with multiple kickoff returns for touchdowns. Brad Smith, one of the best in the business. Now, Brad Smith is a free agent right now, and you have to wonder if part of what they're doing here isn't sending a message that when they do get back to negotiating, that Brad Smith's numbers may not be as high as he wants them to be.
Yes, Smith's one of his best leverage was that he led the NFL in kickoff return average last year with 28.6 yards per kickoff, but now that's going to probably be negated because of this new kickoff rule, so that might drive down his price. I mean, he still does a lot in the wildcat, running the option, can throw out of the backfield, which the Jets like, but one of his main skills was kickoff returning, which will no longer be necessary anymore.
This is one of those interesting things. I mean, obviously, Mike Westhoff, the special teams coach, very well respected. The Jets love him. You know, that he's helped turn that unit around there with the Jets. But, I mean, is it the belief that they would actually make this vote, which has serious long-term implications? It goes well beyond Brad Smith's career if this thing holds for a decade or more, that they would do it for this contract to maybe save $300,000, $400,000, $500,000?
you get the feeling that they probably would, because right now there's no reason for them to vote for this unless they think that. Because, like you said, the Jets have one of the best return games in the league with Brad Smith. He won them a couple of games on his own, pretty much, and he's one of their best skills that they have. And by voting for this measure, they're just kind of eliminating that. And you got to think that leverage in free agency, they have so many big-name free agents that they want to keep, that maybe driving down Smith's price a bit will help them in the long run.
All right, Eli, thank you very much. We need to take another commercial break, but the NFL draft is now around the corner. We got the best in the business in Nolan Naraki, and we'll check in with him on the draft in just a moment. We're back with more Pro Football Weekly. I let the bumps run a little bit longer each segment because I like the music. I don't know what to tell you, but we are having fun today. I'm Hub Arkish along with Eric Edholm. And one thing that Pro Football Weekly, it's not the only thing, but one of the things I should say that we do better than anybody else is cover the NFL college draft. And nobody does it better independently than Nolan Naraki, our senior editor and also the author of our draft preview book and our draft magazine. And Nolan, thanks for joining us again this week. And I want to talk about something, and I want to talk carefully about it because I think it's often misunderstood. The NFL at the combine requires all of the top prospects to take the Wonderlic test. It is one of the most misunderstood or maybe improperly named tests in the world, because everybody says, oh, well, that's an intelligence test, and if you don't do well, you're a dummy. That's not really what it is. It is about intelligence. It's about reacting. It's about perception, or not perception so much as what players perceive to be relevant. And low scores can be a negative indicator to scouts. They don't necessarily mean somebody's dumb. I mean, is that a fair way of putting it? And from the scouts that you talk to, how much weight do they really put in this test?
I think teams really look a lot harder at football intelligence and how a player performs, how well they can assimilate a playbook and really understand the finer points at a position. You know, you look at the Wonderlic, that's really all it is. It's a flag. It's a sign that, you know, maybe a scout has to go back into a school and figure out how this guy learns best, talk to his college coaches, talk to his high school coaches, and just figure out how he learns. Is he a visual learner? You know, does it need to be on the board? Are there certain ways that they got to walk him through in pregame? I mean, everybody learns a little bit differently, and I think that when it comes down to it, that's really the most important part of it. There have been plenty of players through the years. You look at Donovan McNabb scored a 14. Steve McNair scored a 15. Jim Kelly, 15. There have been plenty of great NFL players that didn't fare the best on the test. So, you know, it just goes to show you it doesn't necessarily translate to the field.
Well, and we have to add, not only became good players, but are obviously very bright guys. I mean, Donovan McNabb is a great example. Darrell Revis didn't score well. Andre Johnson. These are guys who become great football players, become good citizens in the community. And so be careful how much weight you put in it. But now, if you are a scout and you're looking at players like you love, maybe a Patrick Peterson at cornerback or A.J. Green at wide receiver, two guys who figure to be top five, at least top 10 picks, these are a couple players who, quite frankly, didn't score that well on the test. And so how much of an impact do you expect that to have?
You can see a little bit of it in Patrick Peterson's film. You know, he freelances. He doesn't have great instincts. He gets caught with his eyes in the backfield. So I think that's the greater concern, more so than any particular test. But, you know, he's a game-breaking returner, and he's an excellent press cornerback. And when you let him play out on an island and just match up man for man with a receiver, he does an excellent job. So he's still got tremendous value. I don't see it affecting him one bit. And I think A.J. Green is still in consideration for to be the top pick, overall pick in this draft. Even though the receiver position doesn't tend to go there, I think he's that type of talent. You know, he's right up in that class with Calvin Johnson. And, you know, he's proven himself. He's one of the easiest evaluations in this year's draft. And he's just phenomenal in all areas. So I don't think it's going to affect either on draft day.
I think if you're looking strictly at the Wonderlic, Nolan, you see some of the highest scores come at quarterback. We don't want to just mention the low-end guys, but Greg McElroy of Alabama scored a 43, an outstanding score. I believe 50 is the highest you can even get. I think one NFL player's ever reached that level. Offensive line is also another position that tends to be on the higher end of scores. You know, Anthony Costanzo from Boston College scored a 41. Danny Watkins, a guard and a tackle from Baylor, scored a 40. Stefan Wisniewski, 32, was the highest center in our listings. I'm just curious, does that mean the offensive linemen require a little bit more intelligence to handle schemes, or is there something to it? I mean, are there positions where you can kind of get away with having a lower score, perhaps?
I think running back and receiver are definitely two positions. If you look at the averages this year, quarterback was the highest at 27, and offensive line in general, it was 24. 324 for the offensive lineman. And I think you do need to be a little bit more intelligent on the offensive side of the ball. You know, you got to be aware of protections. You got to be aware of creative blitz packages. You got to be able to think and react quickly. So I think there's definitely an emphasis on those two positions. But on the other side, you know, you look at some of those high scorers. You look at a guy like Greg McElroy from Alabama or Nate Enderle from Idaho. You know, they both scored around 40. And what you see on the field is that they tend to play a little bit too cerebral. You know, they're overly analytical. They don't go through their reads quite as instinctively as you'd like and pull that trigger. So, you know, it could work the opposite way as well, where, you know, guys are too smart. So, you know, both extremes can have an impact.
You know, Nolan, one thing that jumps out of the notes at me is, as Eric mentioned, some of the top players. You got Costanzo at offensive tackle, Prince Amukamara at cornerback. You've got Stefan Winooski at center. And yet I look at one position at defensive end, J.J. Watt, Cameron Jordan, Ryan Kerrigan, Cameron Hayward, and Robert Quinn, five of the top six scorers, all five are going in the first two rounds. And you look at a player like Quinn, who people talk about his off-the-field problems, yet obviously this is a very bright kid. Why are the scores so high on some of the top players at defensive end?
I think it just goes to show you how strong this class is. I'm not sure it's any one characteristic in particular as much as it is the strength in this year's defensive line class. You know, there's a number of ways to look at it, and you can break it down and slice it a lot of different ways, but I think it just really speaks to the volume in that class.
All right, Nolan, thank you very much. We're going to be checking in with Nolan every week going forward, start our position-by-position breakdowns next week. Right now, we take our last commercial break, and then we got the Publisher's Pen coming up.
And now with the Publisher's Pen, the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Eric, thank you very much. You know, I know we've talked a little bit, maybe too much already, about this rule change on kickoffs in the NFL, but I think it's interesting for a number of reasons beyond just the impact it's going to have on individual players like the Devin Hesters and Joshua Cribbs of the world, beyond the impact it has on teams, and maybe the impact it really has on the current labor impasse in negotiations. Because, you know, the bottom line, folks, is that the competition committee and the owners and the people on that committee, both coaches and front office folks, have absolutely insisted that this is about making the game safer. Well, but then you stop and scratch your head, because when you realize that the rule that actually got changed, all they did was move the ball up 5 yards. A lot of kickers can't get the ball to the end zone from the 30 anyway. Maybe they're going to eliminate 10%, 15% of the kickoffs. I don't think this rule, as it got instituted, is going to have a big impact on the game. But here's the question. How can you say you're making the game safer by removing a couple plays but wanting to add two games to the back of the schedule? One of the theories I've heard from folks is that the owners are going to come up with a number of rules like this and say, look at all we're doing to make the game safer, so the extra two games shouldn't be such a big deal. Because for those of you who believe they're off the table, you're kidding yourself. Both the owners and the players still know it's an important part of their revenue projections down the road, and I think that as much as anything is about what this kickoff change is all about. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Our thanks to Randy Meyer, does such a great job every week as our executive producer and engineer. Syndication Networks is our syndicator, and of course the folks who arrange all our clearances to bring to you at stations around the country. And most of all, we want to thank all of you. We appreciate you being there so much. We really are glad you're able to listen, and we hope you'll be back again to join us next week for Pro Football Weekly, same time, same station. Take care, everybody.